following program is recommended for mature individuals and may contain material unsuitable for morons, cretins, and dishwipes. If you are a moron or a member of the PTL Club, please turn off your radio, because we don't need any more stupid, narrow-minded, pencil-neck geeks who wouldn't know the First Amendment if it came up and bit them on the butt. Thank you.
Welcome to episode 10 of Chat with a Cap. This is being recorded after sim number 9 in the 1981 season. That's season number 2. The trade deadline is passed. The All-Star weekend is passed. And we have the opportunity to react to both. Unfortunately, there were not nearly as many trades as I thought might have gone down as we went into the All-Star weekend. But we'll start by breaking down the trades and see what did happen, because I think there was obviously one big move, but there were a couple of moves that came even a little bit before we got to the weekend. So backing it up, and this is something that I think I should mention too, one of the rules that we have in the NPPDSL is that a player cannot be traded for 60 days, following a particular trade. Players in the off season cannot be acquired until after Sim 3, which corresponds to December the 15th. The trade deadline occurs between Sim 7 and 8, which is the February 15th date in game, which means there are 62 days, I guess, since December and January each have 31 days, between the end of Sim 3 and the end of Sim 7. With the trade deadline happening when lineups are due for Sim 8, that means there is an opportunity for the enterprising traders to make a trade for a player acquired in the offseason, which will be more relevant as we go forward. It hasn't really been too relevant with creation draft contracts. But as free agency starts and players start moving teams that way, if you can pick a player up on December the 15th after Sim 3, you can move them between Sim 7 and 8 right before the trade deadline. That didn't come into play this season, but I did think it was interesting as we look through the transactions list that there was one trade that happened there, and that was David Greenwood going to the Bullets from the Supersonics. In return, the Supersonics got the Bullets' first-round pick in 1982 in Orlando Woolridge. I think this is definitely a case of the Sonics trying to accumulate assets and the Bullets trying to accumulate win-now pieces. David Greenwood is a pretty nice win-now piece. Orlando Woolridge had some potential before the training camp smite happened to him. He might still have potential, but now he's probably even farther away from that. Could be a long-term prospect. So the real value here is probably that Bullets first-round pick for David Greenwood. I think that trade is a little bit of a wash considering the direction each team is going. The Bullets are trying to accumulate young win-now pieces, and the Sonics are trying to accumulate draft picks. So that it's a pretty clear pretty clear what happened in this trade. And again, Woolridge or Greenwood could have been traded going into the trade deadline, but none of the other trades that happened were early enough to have that happen. On the 16th of January, so this was following, I think, Sim 5, the Trailblazers sent a couple of picks this season, one first, one second. The second round is going to be toward the end of the round, so it really means nothing. And a bunch of cap filler to pry Darwin Cook and Norm Nixon off of the Trailblazers. Again, this is the Supersonics trying to pick up draft assets and the Trailblazers trying to pick up win now pieces. It's a pretty easy trade to understand in terms of what was going on there. Which takes us to the date of the trade deadline, February 15th, where we didn't see a ton of movement in terms of volume, but we did see one very substantial trade. We'll start with the less substantial trade. This was a tinkering around the margins trade, wherein Ronnie Lester and Eddie Jordan went between the Pistons and the Warriors. These are guys that are eighth or ninth men at best, so it's not worth... I think going too deeply into it, obviously, these are the kind of trades that I think really help good teams, is these tinkering on the margins trades, but they don't transformatively affect the team. The transformative trade, of course, was the Bullets Kings trade, wherein Calvin Natt went to the Kings and Jack Sikma and two first round picks went back to the Bullets. I think I've done a lot of harping on the Kings in this podcast, mostly because I couldn't see where they were going to have a true go-to superstar. I mean, Sikma is a nice player and definitely above average, but I didn't think he was an A-plus player. Now I see it. Calvin Natt is an A-plus player. He gives the Kings their number one option. He's, I think, 25. Now, Sikma's only 26, but he's just not the dynamic scorer that Nat is. Sikma is more of like a, he's going to get you 12 to 18 every single game, and you're going to get 7 to 10 rebounds. You're not going to get a 40-point outburst. You're not going to get a 50-point outburst. He's just going to be there, just solid. And so I think this probably takes the Bullets a step back. I don't think they're going to be able to hang in there with the Knicks to grab the Atlantic Division. But I suspect... the Bullets are fine with that because they did pick up a quality big man in an Eastern Conference that is absolutely chock full of them, and they get another couple of bites at the apple in terms of drafting players with the Kings picks. Now, I don't think the Kings picks will be great, but all it takes is one good training camp boost to take a player that's a marginal starter and make him into a strong starter, and I'm guessing the Bullets are going to try for that and try to... make their way through the gauntlet of the next couple of seasons by going with depth instead of with star quality. For the Kings, I think this definitely elevates them to be contenders because now you have to figure out how to stop Calvin Natt, which, you didn't lose sleep over Sikma. You knew he'd get his, but he wasn't going to go for 40 or 50 on you. And I think the proof is in the pudding if you look at the scoring that Nat has done since the trade. Breaking down his scoring numbers, 43, 30, 41, 33, 24, 27, 51, 22, 14 and 11, 41, 36, 43. So occasionally he has a quote-unquote bad game where he's scoring only in the tens or mid-teens. But mostly he's been up in the 30s, 40s, and even a 50. So... I really like that trade for the Kings, and I think that was the Bullets kind of waving the white flag to the Knicks this season and hoping to reload in the offseason. There's also been quite a bit of talk about the trade that didn't happen, and there was a rumored trade between the Bullets and the Lakers that wound up not happening. Due to the Lakers not being able to be online to confirm it prior to the trade deadline. And this speaks to a habit that I have observed among GMs that I have never really understood, and that is the procrastination habit. I remember reading a piece from Dave Barry years and years ago. He's a humor columnist, used to be, I think, at the Miami Herald. Anyway, based out of Miami, and he said the reason men don't want to get married is he's worried, 25 years from now he might be old, fat, and balding and passing by a hot tub full of supermodels that invite him to come in and hang out with them, and because he's married he won't be able to do it. I think it's like, is that realistic? Is that ever going to happen? Probably not. And I think there's a lot of wish casting and a lot of what-ifing, and I touched on this a little bit in terms of referencing timidity in my town hall post earlier today. player or GMs seem to hang on to players and they'll talk about a deal and they'll think, okay, I've got this deal in place. Now let me try to go find something better. And usually something better isn't forthcoming, and you've already put forth the effort in putting the one deal together. Now, if two or three deals come to you at the same time, you know, you put a player on the trade block and you get three offers and you're trying to sort through them, that's fine. But if you've really only got one offer, don't put it on hold and try to find something better. Pull the darn trigger. I think a lot of the times things don't get done due to a worry, oh, could I do better? And again, it's the giving up, you know, marrying your sweetheart on the chance that 25 years from now, a hot tub full of supermodels is going to ask you to join them. It's probably not going to happen. It's one of the things I've always tried to subscribe to. Obviously, if somebody, you know, messages me, let's say an hour before the trade deadline with a deal that I think is good, I'm going to try to jump in and take a look at it. But generally, the trade deadline happens on Wednesday. Really, I think prior to Sim 7, after Sim 6, you have a pretty good idea where your team is going. You probably want to start talks, you know, that Friday. Talks can go over the weekend. You can maybe make tweaks based on Monday's results. But even between Monday and Wednesday, you have at least 48 hours, usually, between the Sim and the trade deadline to figure out a trade. That should be more than enough time. And really, if you're planning on making a trade deadline move, those talks should start happening after Sim 6, which is usually on a Friday, meaning you've had 5 days to get things done. And to be honest, if you've had 5 days to get things done and you're not ready to pull the trigger, waiting to the last minute is not going to help you decide to pull the trigger. You should have a plan and you should go ahead and make that call and just execute. And the other thing, and I know I've seen Darth complaining about this a little bit, is what I would call Sim League etiquette. And that is, as a GM, you're going to take a lot of trade offers, or at least messages from teams, where the trade is bad. I would recommend that for politeness sake, it's probably better to respond with a no thanks, I'm not moving XYZ, than just not responding to the trade at all, because then the other person doesn't know, are they thinking about it? Is it a possibility? Do I need to wait? At least if you tell them, no, not interested, it heads things off. And most good GMs will not badger you about a player continuously. They might check in once a season, which I think is reasonable. If you're getting badgered with trade offers, maybe you'll complain to the commissioner, say, hey, can you get this guy to stop messaging me? But if someone sends you like, you know, one offer a season and you're not interested, do them the courtesy of saying no so that they can move on and try to get other things going. Again, it's just an etiquette thing. But I think generally you won't wind up on the Bucks no trade list if you tell them, no, I'm not really interested in that. You will wind up on the Bucks no trade list if you ghost them. So I guess just in general, that would be my advice for teams, and we'll come back to that in a minute about boldness and timidity. I thought the town hall question today was kind of thought-provoking, where it talked about what's the difference between teams that are winning and losing. And I think really the difference has been activity and boldness. I think there are two varieties of losing teams right now. There are teams that are deliberately and consciously tanking. And I think the Supersonics would be a good example of that based on the trades that we saw. You know, they traded away David Greenwood. They traded away Norm Nixon. And they're doing so in order to accumulate picks, to be bad, to improve their own lotto standing this season, and to have young assets to add to that. But you can see the path for in 2 to 3 seasons, they accumulate young assets, they let them mature through training camp, and they improve. And that's how they're going to get better. Contrast that with teams that are just kind of going through the motions. You don't see them updating the trade blocks. You don't see them responding to trades. You don't see them participating in the league other than doing the bare minimum. And these are the teams that, in general, are kind of sliding toward oblivion. And especially bad is when you don't, you know, I don't want to call 78 out directly here, but I kind of have to, when you don't bother to protect your players in training camp with insurance. It seems to me like that should be the bare minimum you want to do, is make sure at least that your young guys don't get worse. When we saw Larry Bird take the hit in training camp this season, I think a lot of people were not just, sad on 78's behalf, but a little bit disappointed and maybe even mad at 78. Like, how could you do that to yourself? And it's a good question. And so it speaks to the level of commitment. Not everybody is going to have the same level of commitment, say, as a commissioner who checks the site multiple times a day. But I think checking in at least once every 2 to 3 days, once per sim, so you can adjust your lineup if somebody is injured, so you can respond no thanks to all those bad trade offers you're getting, is not unreasonable. I think once a week is the bare minimum. But you absolutely positively should check in a couple of times during the off season, especially as we're coming up on an off season where there will be some good players available. There was not much available last free agency. This free agency, there's going to be some players that I think a lot of people will be interested in. And it's going to start shaping contractually how the league looks going forward. We haven't had to deal a whole lot with salary cap issues because the creation draft contracts are a little bit low. They give you plenty of salary cap space to work with, but as players start getting re-signed to max deals, you better believe cap space is going to quickly become a premium commodity. Be careful of that. And we'll talk a little bit more probably in the next episode about some potential free agents. I don't want to jump ahead here. I can also point out, as long as we're talking about winners and losers, that I think we've seen kind of the shakeout that has led to the dichotomy where I think in the West there are six teams that it's very obvious are going to make the playoffs and six teams that are not. In the East, I think there are four teams that are obviously out. There are three teams that are all kind of fighting for the last two spots. Honestly, not really. I think the Celtics have probably dropped far enough back now behind the Bulls that the Celtics are not going to make the playoffs this season, which means I think our six playoff teams are locked in. Now, what seed do they get? That's, of course, subject to change. It's kind of early now in the season, relatively speaking. Last season, it went all the way down to the wire. This season, I think the playoff teams are already crystal clear. I suspect free agency will be the opportunity for that to start equalizing a bit because, again, the superstars aren't available yet, but some of the bench players that have had a training camp bump or some of the better bench players are going to be available, and that's something that people should be paying attention to. When we come back, I want to revive a segment that I kind of liked from the old league. I don't have the old AI recordings, but I wanted to real quickly do some overrated, underrated, and properly rated for the various teams. So I'll take a quick break and we'll be back.
Hi, I'm Lance Anderson. You know me from my movies Terminal Intensity, Multiple Explosions, and Terminal Intensity 2. But back in Appleton, Wisconsin, Miss Edith Parker knew me as the boy who hated geometry.
Hypotenuse, Lance.
Ow!
Miss Parker tried to teach me cosines, but I was too busy trying to entertain my classmates.
You'll never get anywhere in life if you don't learn how to compute the volume of a cube, Lance.
Ow!
Well, I never did get geometry, but I did make over $20 million for my last movie. So if you're listening, Ms. Parker, screw you and screw geometry. Teachers, who needs them?
Paid for with extra cash Lance Anderson found under the seat in his Porsche.
This week on Zenora, Queen of Battle, a plan is hatched.
Zenora, what should we do?
We'll have to make them think we're enemies. Quick, fake a catfight.
Ah, my hair!
And a friendship is strengthened.
That catfight got me so dusty.
Here, let me give you a sponge bath.
All on the next Zenora.
So while we were at break, I changed my mind a little bit, and I wanted to briefly touch on the All-Star results, and that will kind of lead us in to overrated, underrated, properly rated. And so just real quick to review the All-Star results for the weekend. The rookie and sophomore rosters, again, I think are a good indicator of where the league is going and what teams you can expect to be strong for a while. For the rookies, you had as starters Alton Lister of the Warriors, Mark Aguirre and Isaiah Thomas of the Spurs, Jay Vincent and Eddie Johnson of the Kings. Jay Vincent, honestly, has been a surprise to me. I think Darth has done a very good job of uncovering some talent there. On the rookie bench, you had Herb Williams of the Nets, Kelly Chipuka of the Lakers, Kurt Rambis of the Blazers, Devin McKenna of the Cavaliers, Darnell Valentine of the Bullets, Buck Williams of the Knicks, and Tom Chambers of the Jazz. Kind of interesting to see Buck Williams in a wild card spot here. You would have thought, given how well the Knicks have played, he might have been a little higher up on this list, but apparently Mark Aguirre and Kelly Chipuka have made bigger contributions in the eyes of the Sim voters than Buck Williams has, so maybe there's a little bit of underrated there. For the sophomores, you've got Mike Kaminsky of the Kings, Edgar Jones of the Bulls, Kiki Vandeweghe of the Jazz, Andrew Tooney of the Pistons, and Johnny Moore of the Mavericks as your starters. Your bench is McHale of the Spurs, Cureton of the Bullets, Woodson of the Sixers, Daryl Griffith of the Knicks, Larry Drew of the Nets, Joe Barry Carroll of the Pacers, and James Donaldson of the Lakers. I guess just a very quick snapshot. You'll notice the Jazz have one rookie and one sophomore on the team. The Spurs have two rookies and one sophomore. The Kings have two rookies and one sophomore. So these are the, I guess, young up-and-comers. You know, the Lakers have one sophomore, one rookie. So these are the teams that have players that are contributing significantly now and have a bright future. So I think, you know, I think everybody knows the Lakers have been looking for a power forward for a while. Once they find that power forward, I think, you know, they will be a force to be reckoned with. The Spurs and the Kings, obviously the Spurs are having a rough go of it this season, but you know, they're playing rookies, give it 2-3 years and they'll grow into it. The Kings are playing well now. In the three-point shootout, you saw Kiki Vandeweghe and Larry Bird, Eddie Johnson, Gerald Henderson, Daryl Griffith, and Kevin Grevy of the 76ers, with the finals being Bird over Vandeweghe and Johnson. Again, with scores of 13 in the first round, 12 in the second round, this speaks to how much the three-point shot is not really utilized in the current Sim League. So again, take your three-point ratings with a grain of salt. In the slam dunk contest, you had Magic Johnson of the Suns, Calvin Nano of the Bullets, Buck Williams of the Knicks, Kurt Rambis of the Blazers, Bernard King of the Celtics, and Adrian Dantley of the Pacers. You may remember Bernard King won this last year, came back to defend his title, didn't do it. I mentioned this on the live call. It kind of cracked me up a little bit that Magic Johnson of the Suns won the slam dunk contest. I've seen Magic dunk before, but when I think Magic Johnson going to the hoop, I don't usually think dunking. Usually it's more of a scoop layup. So you know, it amuses me that he was able to win the slam dunk contest. And then for the All-Stars, for the Western Conference, you had Mike Kaminsky of the Kings, Moses Malone of the Warriors, Magic Johnson of the Suns, George Gervin of the Mavericks, Reggie Theus of the Clippers, McHale of the Spurs, Roundfield of the Nuggets, Vandeweghe of the Jazz, World Be Free of the Lakers, Johnny Moore of the Mavs, Alex English of the Nuggets, and Larry Bird of the Rockets as your bench. My initial reaction here is twofold. Number one, it's very interesting that you see a much bigger spread of teams, I think, than you did last season. You only see two teams, at least as I look at it, with two All-Stars on the West side, and that's the Nuggets with English and Roundfield, and the Mavericks with Moore and Gervin. And honestly, it surprises me a little bit because the Mavericks, you would think with two All-Stars, should be doing better than they are, but they're out of the playoffs, they're struggling to stay 500. And I don't think that's likely to turn around soon. So they need to get these two more help. For the East, you had Joe Barry Carroll of the Pacers, Daryl Dawkins of the Nets, Bernard King of the Celtics, Adrian Dantley of the Pacers, Cindy Moncrief of the Cavaliers, And then on the bench, you had Eldon Hayes of the Celtics, Robert Parrish of the Bucks, Calvin Natt of the Bullets, Andrew Toney of the Pistons, Maurice Cheeks of the Celtics, Jim Paxson of the Cavaliers, and Julius Erving of the Knicks. And what strikes me in that group is the only player there that is more than, I think, 28 years old is Eldon Hayes. Maybe Julius Erving's 29 or 30. But that means 10 of your 12 Eastern guys are young and likely to be fixtures for a while. Again, you know, looking at teams that have two All-Stars, Eldon Hayes and Bernard King with the Celtics are a 500 team. The Pacers have two All-Stars, and they're pushing the Bucks for the division again. The Cavaliers have two All-Stars, and they're in the playoffs. So, you know, here, I think the notable omission of a team that, you know, doesn't have an All-Star is the Bulls. I think the Bulls have done very well this season. It's interesting that you don't see an All-Star. Maybe that's because they're getting more team play. I think in the West, the team that, you know, has a glaring omission is the Blazers, you know, leading the division, and not having an All-Star is definitely an interesting situation to be in. But as promised, I want to get on to the overrated, underrated, and properly rated segment. So I picked each team and I grabbed one player that I thought was overrated, underrated, or properly rated. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to do these in the order that they appear in the standings pages. So we will start with the Knicks. For the Knicks, I think Daryl Griffith is properly rated. He took a bump in training camp, came up to purple potential, but he's not there yet. He is not scoring or throwing assists on the level that I think you'd like to see a purple current player doing, but he's averaging 22 points and almost six assists a game. That's six rebounds a game and about three assists a game. So, Griffith is performing, but he's not out of this world yet. He's not paid like a megastar. I think he's probably untouchable with the Knicks, but I don't see them structuring their team around him just yet, and so that's why I would say properly rated. For the Bullets, I think underrated is Jack Sikma. I think a lot of people overreacted when they saw Calvin Natt going over to the Kings and were wondering, oh my gosh, what are the Bullets doing? I think Sikma is actually, you know, a pretty decent player. I mentioned it earlier. I don't expect him to explode for 30 or 40 points in any given game, but I expect him to be steady. And, looking at his numbers, he's averaging 18 points, almost nine rebounds, a couple of assists on the season, shooting 51%. So, again, not spectacular, but certainly steady. You know, he's not going to be able to beat out Moses Malone, but he'll be able to hold his own against most players he's faced up with. For the Celtics, I would say Bernard King is properly rated. King was what the Celtics got back in their trade of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and I think if you ask them would they do it again, I think the answer is yes, because King has just been on a tear this season. I think he was probably held back in terms of statistical production a little bit last season by the Blazers' mob mentality. It's been remarked upon that the Blazers generally don't have one superstar player. They kill you with depth, and I think Bernard was definitely held back a little bit by that. Now on the Celtics, he's really coming into his own. I don't think he's overrated, and I don't think he's underrated either. I think there were some people that had some doubts but thought it was fine. I don't think anybody looks at him and thinks he's an MVP like Magic or like Moses, so that's why I would call him properly rated. For the Nets, I'm going to have to call Herb Williams, their first-round draft pick, overrated. They gave Herb the starting spot. They benched George Johnson. And their win percentage has plummeted. Last season, they made a surprise run to the finals. This season, they're struggling to win a third of their games. And the only real change to the lineup has been Johnson out, Williams in. And so I think, you know, based on that, I have to call Herb Williams a little bit overrated here. And you know, maybe they need to go back to George Johnson. He'll probably be good in a couple of years, but he's just not there yet. For the 76ers, another team that I think has an overrated player, and that is Bob Wilkerson. And the reason I would call him overrated is He's getting 20 minutes a game. He's getting a ton of burn off the bench, and he's shooting 41% and averaging 8.5 points. Even on a bad team like the 76ers, I think you would rather see a little more, I guess, efficient production from a player that you're giving 20 minutes a game to. Maybe it's just a function of there's not enough other good players on the team. I don't know. Moving on to the Bucks, Bill Laimbeer is underrated. I know his stats are only 11.3 points and 8.2 rebounds, but what you want to look at is the record the Bucks had when he went out with an injury versus the rest of the season. You know, before he went out with an injury, they were winning like 85% of their games. After he went out with the injury, that dropped to, you know, just over 50%. So clearly, even though he's not putting up huge stats, Laimbeer is a huge part of what they're doing. So definitely underrated for the Bucks is Bill Laimbeer. For the Pacers, the player that I think, at least in my opinion, is underrated for them is Kermit Washington. And the reason I say that is if you take a look at the Blazers' plus-minus numbers, Jobari Carroll and Adrian Dantley, their two stars, had the best plus-minus ratings. Larry Smith, who I would consider their third star, has a plus-minus rating of 5.1. Kermit Washington, in just 22 minutes per game, also has a plus-5.1, and that's off the bench, so he's not even spending a ton of time with JBC and Adrian Dantley. So I think, you know, Kermit Washington, even though his stats don't show you great numbers in terms of points and rebounds, clearly his defense is making a big difference in Indiana. And so I would call Kermit Washington of the Pacers underrated. For the Cavaliers, I think Sidney Moncrief is properly rated. Sidney has been doing yeoman's work the last two seasons. He's got the highest plus minus on the Cavaliers. He's made two all-star teams as a starter. He's averaging 25 and 5. He even shoots the ball remarkably well for a point guard at 55%. So I think, you know, again, he's not on the level of, say, a Moses Malone or a Magic Johnson, but the fact that he has started two consecutive all-star games tells me that the game is properly rating him and he's getting the minutes he deserves. On the Chicago Bulls, Michael Cooper, I think, is now properly rated. I think he was a little bit overrated his first season. I think expectations have now turned to realize he's not going to be a great scorer. They need to put other scorers around him. Kyle Macy does that. Robert Reed does that to some degree. Steve Johnson is even capable of doing that. And so now Cooper is just a solid, you know, 12, 4.5, 5.5 with a couple of steals guy. He's no longer being expected to carry things in Chicago. And so I think after being overrated last year, he's properly rated this year, maybe in danger of moving into the underrated category. For the Hawks, I would call Purvis Short underrated. And the reason why is, have you heard of Purvis Short? Do you know what he's doing? For the worst team in the Central Division, he's averaging almost 17 points, 5 boards, and 3 assists on 46% shooting. And I think he's part of the reason the Hawks actually win occasionally. And, you know, at the ripe old age, and I'm putting that in air quotes, which you can't see on a podcast, of 24, I think he should be a big part of the Hawks' plans going forward. But again, underrated just due to playing on a team that not a lot of players or people are talking about. For the Pistons, I think Kevin Cunnert is underrated. And this may come as a little bit of a surprise to folks, but if I take a look at Kevin's splits and, you know, just kind of how he's been doing, even though the Pistons statistically are one of the worst teams in the league, and most of their starters have a plus-minus rating of almost minus 10. Cunnert is only at minus 5.2. He's averaging 48% from the field, but most importantly, if I look at his defensive rating numbers, and again, the defensive rating compares how your player does when he's on the floor versus the opposing team. The Pistons' defensive rating when Cunnert is on the floor is 105.8. Compare that to their overall defensive rating, which I'm pulling up here in a minute here. I should have had this ready to go. But the overall defensive efficiency for the Pistons is 110.7. So he's a net plus five there. So again, this is something that doesn't necessarily show up in terms of counting stats, but shows up on the defensive end. He takes the Pistons from an abysmal defensive team to just a bad defensive team, which to me means he individually is probably a pretty good defender. Next up, we go to the Midwest. The Kings' Calvin Knapp is properly rated. He's a franchise cornerstone. I think everybody sees him as such. As mentioned earlier, he's been absolutely on fire since coming to the Kings, and I think he makes the Kings quite scary, and rightly so. Calvin Knapp is properly rated. For the Nuggets, and I have to put a mea culpa in here because I probably contributed to this, but I think John Lucas is underrated. And the reason I say that is, you know, you take a look at the Nuggets' big two, and everybody thinks of Dan Roundfield and Alex English. Third on their team in plus-minus, despite averaging just 10 points a game, is John Lucas. And I think it's his passing, those 11.4 assists, elevate the rest of the team. And so I know I've kind of bashed on John Lucas in past podcasts, but I got to give him his flowers here. I think he is now underrated. Moving on to the Utah Jazz, I think we have an overrated player in Mike Dunleavy. Mike Dunleavy has started most of the season. He's getting 33 minutes per game, and he's shooting 43% from the floor and averaging a couple of turnovers and three personal fouls per game. I just think there are better options out there for the Jazz to use. And again, using one of my more, favorite metrics for looking at, you know, the stuff you can't track, defense and stuff, the plus-minus rating. Dunleavy's plus-minus rating is actually a negative 0.1, whereas if you look at the guy who is ostensibly his backup in Paul Westphal, his is a 2.3. So I think maybe a little less Dunleavy, a little more Paul Westphal is warranted, and the fact that he's getting so many minutes tells me, at least for the Jazz, he's a little bit overrated. Moving on to the Mavericks, I think we have a player who is properly rated in Mike McGee. McGee is averaging just 15 minutes on the season. His field goal percentage is almost 51%. He's only averaging 5.7 points per game, and if you take a look at him as a yellow-blue, I think one mistake people often make is falling in love with that potential number, those potential ratings. Oh, he's got a B in potential and inside and jump shot, and a B in perimeter defense, and an A in steals. But if you look at his current ratings, he's, you know, a D in inside. He's a C in jump shot. He's a D, and I guess low C in perimeter defense. He's a B in steals, so he's not there yet. And so I call him properly rated because while the Mavericks are hanging on to him and not shopping him, they are also not playing him a ton because he needs a couple more seasons to bake before he's ready to go. Next up for the Rockets, I think Otis Birdsong is underrated. Everybody looks at the Rockets and we all think of either Frank Johnson because he was drafted probably too high, and what were they doing? Or they look at Larry Bird and, oh my gosh, he wasn't protected by TC Insurance. What are they doing? And we look right past Otis Birdsong, who's averaging 25 points a game on 48% shooting from the shooting guard spot. And you know, Birdsong's numbers are really, really good. And so I think because nobody is paying attention to him, that makes him an underrated player. Moving on to the San Antonio Spurs, I would call for them, their underrated player is Kelvin Ramsey. We saw what happened to the Spurs last season when he went down with an injury. They got knocked out of the playoffs thanks to not having him at point guard. They've started Isaiah this season, which I can understand why. Isaiah is a phenomenal talent, but I'm not entirely sure it wouldn't have been a better idea instead of starting Don Collins, whose numbers are pretty underwhelming, to put Ramsey as their starting shooting guard or even as their starting point guard and maybe have Isaiah be their starting shooting guard. At any rate, I think there's room for both Ramsey and Thomas in the backcourt. Excuse me. And because of that, I think Ramsey has been underrated this season. Moving on to the Blazers, I think David Thompson is their player that is underrated, and I think it's because he's been green coloration pretty much since the league started, but yet he's been producing on the level of, say, a World Be Free. In about 30 minutes per game, he's averaging 20 points per game. He shoots almost 50%, gets to the line a ton, gets a few blocks, which is really nice for a point guard. So David Thompson, to me, is the player on the Blazers that is underrated. For the Warriors, I think they have an overrated player in Mike Glenn. And the reason I think he's overrated is, again, he's getting about 30 minutes per game. He even gets occasional spot starts. But to go to one of these metrics that I use when looking at kind of hidden numbers under players, Mike Mitchell has a +9 when he's on the floor. James Bailey +4 or +5.9. Phil Ford +4.6. Moses +4. Eddie Johnson +3. Alton Lister +2. Mike Glenn 0.7. So even though he's getting the lion's share of minutes with Moses, with Eddie, with Alton Lister, his plus minus is worse than all of them, meaning he's a net liability. And he's also, I think, dragging the team down a little bit because as a team, their margin, their plus minus is 4.4, which is right in line with Moses Malone's. So I think maybe a little more of James Bailey and Mike Mitchell and a little less of Mike Glenn is warranted there. For the Suns, I think they have John Long as their properly rated player. Everybody knows Magic is great. Long has been his second banana these past two seasons, and I think he might have been a little bit overrated and overproduced last year when he went for 27 points a game. This year, he's down to around 18.7, shooting 52% from the field, so he's quality but not overwhelming. And I think that probably accounts for the Suns' drop-off this year from a really, really good team to just a good team. And so I think Long is probably properly rated. He's not getting treated like a star, but he's not getting treated like dirt either. Next up for the Clippers, I have Greg Ballard as being overrated. Ballard, again, I'm going to default to my plus-minus numbers. He's got the worst plus-minus numbers on the team at -3.5 per game. He started all 62 games. He's averaging 35 minutes a game. But if you look at the next worst starter, it's Reggie Theus at -1.5. So Ballard is a full 2 points worse than the next best starter. And so that means anytime he's playing without the other starters, he's just absolutely abysmal. And I think it's time probably to explore maybe putting a little heavier dose of Rolando Blackman on the floor and see if he can get you something that Greg Ballard just isn't. I know his color ratings are blue, but I'm just not seeing the production to match that. For the Lakers, for their player that I think is overrated, I think it's World Be Free. And the reason I say that is World is mentioned in almost every post that the Lakers make, kind of as the right hand or the left hand. Well, Jamal Wilkes is the right hand, but if I take a look at Free, he has been a net negative on the season, where all the rest of the Lakers starters, except Jim Brewer, who's a starter in name only, he's only getting 10 minutes a game, are net positives. So I think World Be Free's name recognition and maybe his inside rating of 100 make him look amazing. But if you look at his actual production and what he's giving you when he's on the floor, maybe not so amazing. And maybe that's why, as he's been shopped around, there hasn't been, at least this is my sense, quite the market that the Lakers think there should be for him. My sense is the Lakers think World Be Free is a superstar. I think he's a solid starter, but to me that makes him overrated. And finally, for the Sonics, I think Danny Ainge is overrated. And the reason I say this is because he's been given, right now he's on the bench and inactive. But he's been given 33 minutes a game, and he's scoring 12 points a game. This goes back to, you look at his potentials, and you see C-A-A-A-A-A. But right now, if you look at where their currents are at, you know, his inside is a low D. His jump shot is a mid B. He's not there yet, and he's going to take a couple of seasons to get there. His PER is 12.8 and average is 15. Yes, he's on a bad team in Seattle. Yes, they should probably be force-feeding him minutes to see what he's going to turn into. He's just not there yet. And if Seattle is building around Ainge exclusively, I think they're making a little bit of a mistake. I think he's overrated. So there you have it. Underrated, overrated, properly rated. We'll wrap things up. Next week, we'll probably do some playoff previews. Maybe we'll get into free agency preview. We'll see. But we're heading down the home stretch of the regular season. Hopefully everybody is able to keep their players healthy, and we'll look forward to some exciting playoff matchups as playoff seedings shake out this coming week.